Graphic Audio, a movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Elmer Kelton's The Wolf and the Buffalo. Narrated by Terrence Aselford. With performances by Ken Jackson, Tim Getman, Tony Nam, Thomas Penny, Elliot Dash, Nanette Savard, James Lewis, Evan Casey, Thomas Keegan, David Coyne, Richard Rowan, Anastasia Wilson, Jeff Allen, Michael John Casey, Colleen Delaney, Dexter Hamlet, Nathaniel Perry, Donnie Stevens, Catherine Aselford, Christopher Sheeran, Michael Glenn, Christopher Graybill, Bobby Aselford, and Mort Shelby. The Wolf and the Buffalo, Part 2. Gideon had not realized how popular a white officer could be among black soldiers. Cheering arose from the post grounds as the paymaster's wagon pulled up on the south bank of the Concho, its wheels trailing water. The officer of the guard marched out a fresh detail to conduct the major onto the post in military style, allowing him to drop off the tired and dusty troopers who had accompanied him. Nettles pointed them to the corrals. The fort had looked handsome from out on the prairie, but most welcome sight of all was Jimbo brushing Napoleon's black coat. He had it shining like onyx. Swinging quickly out of the saddle, Gideon half-crushed Jimbo's hand.
Hey, Gid!
I see you made it. Run into any Indians?
Never seen a feather. I want to find out how fast Napoleon could run.
Sergeant Nettles took a slow walk around his black horse, lovingly rubbing him, critically inspecting him for the least sign of abuse. Jimbo stood with the brush against his hip. He was smiling and confident. Nettles' eyes showed he was pleased, but he wouldn't say so. It wasn't military. It wasn't Nettles.
What did the colonel do when you taken him the dispatch?
He called in some officers right quick and got out a couple of patrols. Other companies, though, not ours. Officer of the day taking me right over to the colonel's house soon as he seen what it was all about. Colonel asked me a bunch of questions. Missus, she called in that washwoman's gal, Hannah, to fetch me a dip of cool water. After the water, old missus herself gave me brandy. Out of her own hand, she done. I stood right there in the parlor like I was a white officer come, not just a nigger.
You are not just a nigger. You are a soldier. And don't you forget it.
The sergeant straightened.
Ten Hutt?
He brought up his hand in a salute. Lieutenant Hollander entered the stables.
At ease, men. Go on about your business.
His eyes sought out Nettles and showed considerable pleasure at finding him.
Good to have you back, Sergeant. Things go to hell around here when you're off the post.
The lieutenant did not wait for a reply.
Hello, Charger. I'm afraid you may have trouble living with Jimbo for a while. He's been over at the colonel's house picking in high cotton.
Gideon had never learned to be at ease with the lieutenant. He sensed that the officer expected some light-hearted banter, but he had none in him.
Yes, sir.
He still wished Hollander would cut out that charger business.
You men get your horses curried and fed as quickly as you can. We'll have company formation for the paymaster.
When the lieutenant was gone, Gideon turned back to Jimbo.
You seen Hannah? How'd she look?
Jimbo's smile left him.
What you want food with that yellow gal for? Ain't nothing but trouble Colonel's missus ever finds out. Or that old granny woman either. She'll lay a curse on you.
Riding onto the post, Gideon had looked for Hannah, working behind the shack where the washpot was. His heart had sagged when she was nowhere in sight. As soon as he finished grooming and feeding the brown horse, and before the bugle's assembly call, he hurried to the west of the corrals to look again. She was at the steaming pot, stirring some boiling clothes. Glancing over his shoulder and not seeing Nettles, Gideon joyfully climbed the fence. He sprinted toward Hannah, keeping a watch on the shack in case the old woman should come out. Hannah's face instantly lighted up, but the smile was gone before he reached her. She watched the shack warily.
Gideon, you crazy. Old Granny's liable to come out here anytime, and she's gonna come out mad.
I just had to see you for a minute, Hannah.
He took all the resistance he could muster not to make those last two long steps and grab her into his arms. Her large, dark eyes were distressed.
I know, Gideon, but you got to get going now.
I'll be back tonight, Hannah. You be listening for me.
She shook her head urgently.
No, you stay away from here tonight. Old Granny, she got company coming over.
Company will leave. I don't care how late it is, I'll wait.
No, Gideon, please stay away. Come another night, please.
She turned her head toward the shack, pleading.
I think I hear her coming. Get now. Get quick and don't come back around here tonight.
Gideon was disposed to argue, but her frightened manner stopped him. Anger arose, suddenly, helplessly. Damned old woman.
I'll see you, Hannah.
He started backing off.
Don't you fret. I'm fixing to take you away from her.
He made long strides toward the corrals, looking over his shoulder. When he reached the corral, the old woman still had not appeared. He felt foolish about the haste of his retreat, and the foolishness turned to resentment. He would make up for it. He would be here tonight. He would see Hannah if he had to wait till the roosters crowed over the river. No matter how broke and desperate they had been for most or all of the month, soldiers on payday felt rich as New Orleans slave traders. A profligate spirit ran rampant on the post. Gideon had seen men stand in the pay line and bet the meager wages not yet in their hands on whether a restless doodlebug searching the parade grounds would cross a certain point or turn back. The late afternoon air was too chilly for doodlebugs, but he saw Finley and another trooper bet $5 on whether one of the numerous camp dogs nosing about for refuse would visit a certain tree or not. The dog betrayed Finley. Gideon grimaced, knowing it took the voluble little trooper more than 10 days to earn that $5. Though one of the post officers counted out each soldier's pay, deducting any fees shown on the company record as being owed, the paymaster stood by, watching the operation. When the reckoning was done and the last man had collected his due, the major's gaze drifted to the Griffin soldiers. They had watched with a certain forlorn air, like unwanted strays. He beckoned them with his finger. They approached him and saluted, reluctant because they expected another duty assignment. The major drew a wrinkled bill from his pocket.
Sergeant, I feel as if I have cheated you and your men. You were obliged to forego a rightfully earned celebration at Fort Griffin. I believe St. Angela's flesh pots are the equal of any at Griffin under the hill. If your soldiers cannot get comfortably drunk on $5, it is simply because you do not make the effort. I trust you will make the effort.
The sergeant's grin was widest, but not by much. He accepted the bill with a bow from the waist, a relic of another time. Gideon had no idea how much money a major made, maybe as much as $20 or $30 a month, but he knew $5 was no small gift. Even Dempsey would have to admit that for an officer of such high rank, almost a general, the major was a pretty good sort after all. Because Jimbo kept insisting, and Dempsey and the Griffin troopers kept backing him up, Gideon agreed to go across the river with him for a while. He had to kill some time anyway. They found St. Angela in festive spirits. The paymaster's arrival was always grounds for celebration all around. Of whatever money arrived in the paymaster's wagon, most would be liberally distributed among the townspeople across the river by the time the first rooster crowed the following morning. As always, Gideon made it a point to take only a couple of dollars. The rest was wrapped in a sock in the box at the foot of his bunk. His contingent started at the east end of Concho Avenue and worked its way westward, looking for the place where the music was the prettiest, the girls the friendliest, and the whiskey tolerably drinkable. The combination was not easy to find. Though Gideon found agreeable the warming and calming sensation which whiskey gave him after it had settled into his system, he had not yet gotten to care much for the taste of it, or for the fire it lighted in his mouth and throat before it went down. He sipped it slowly and made it last. He watched Jimbo cut loose and dance alone on the packed earth floor of an adobe dive. He wondered if anybody anywhere had ever really had as much fun as Jimbo appeared to be having. He had a feeling that the hilarity was forced. It was as if the soldiers felt obliged to offset in one wild and uproarious night all the drudgery, all the indignities of 30 long days, and they realized that they never actually could. They tried to make up the difference in noise and show, convincing themselves they were having a grand time they felt was their due. Settling for less would be admitting that the system was cheating them. As the evening wore on, impatience prickled Gideon's skin. He found it difficult to sit here passing the time, pretending to be having fun. The situation was made more difficult by little Finley, who ran out of money early and tried to beg or borrow from his companions. Gideon bought a drink for him, which nearly exhausted what was left of his original $2. Finley was soon whimpering again, making a general nuisance of himself. Finally giving up, he left the saloon without explanation or a by your leave, his red-veined eyes resentful. Gideon decided he too had had enough. Jimbo caught his sleeve.
Where you going? The night's young.
It's getting old to me.
Jimbo made an excuse to the black girl who sat on his lap, and he followed Gideon to the door. Gideon kept walking, so Jimbo trailed him out into the dirt street, catching him by the arm and turning him around.
Kid, you fixing to go to that laundry gal?
It wasn't anybody's business.
If I take that notion?
The show of hilarity was gone. Jimbo was dead serious.
Ain't nothing but trouble for you over there.
What trouble? That little old woman? The day I take it in my head to marry Hannah, that old woman ain't going to amount to one good spit in the Concho River.
There's more to it than you got any idea.
Like what?
I can't tell you, Gid. I just wish you'd stay away.
You don't understand.
Jimbo shrugged, giving up.
Don't reckon I do.
He stood hunched-shouldered as Gideon walked down the street toward the crossing. Gideon's pulse quickened, his eyes searching eagerly for the laundry shack in the moonlight. Coming up to the rear of the shack, he saw a couple of coals still blowing weakly beneath the pot. He thought idly that an ill wind could pick up sparks and move them into something combustible like hay. Somebody ought to caution the washerwomen about such as that. But it was not his job. He saw no light in the shack and took that for a favorable sign. The old woman's company must be gone. He walked around to the front, whistling softly, knowing old Granny couldn't hear.
Hannah! It's me, Gideon!
Too late, he saw the tiny form sitting in a straight chair, leaned back against the outside wall by the front door. He saw the soft glow of her pipe an instant before the granny woman looked around. She jumped up from the chair with a surprising agility and came at him with the speed of a wild animal.
Who you be? What you doing messing around here?
Surprised, Gideon took two steps backwards. She was on him like a wildcat, her spindly little fingers closing over the lapels of his coat, reminding him more of claws than of hands. Her breath in his face was evil of tobacco and bad teeth.
I know you, nigga. I've told you before. Ain't no common soldier gonna sniff around my Hannah.
A man suddenly stood in the front door, wearing long underwear unbuttoned all the way down.
What goes on out here?
It was a white man's voice, with the commanding tone of an officer. The old woman had a surprising strength. In his confusion, Gideon let her whirl him around and push him toward the open door. He stumbled through it, into the officer who stood there. He threw up his hands defensively, striking the officer a weak, unintentional blow. The man's fist came around in a furious arc that sent Gideon crashing to the hard earth floor. His hat rolled away. Hannah was on her knees on the bed. Even in the reflected glow of moonlight, Gideon knew she was naked. Captain Newton grabbed Gideon's coat, attempting to pull him back to his feet. Gideon tried to draw away and stumbled.
You black son of a bitch!
From trousers hanging on the back of a chair, he pulled loose his belt and began to swing it at Gideon, using it like a whip. Gideon put his arms over his face. The belt hissed, most of the blows striking his coat, a few stinging fiercely across the back of his head and neck. A momentary panic came over him. Panic born of those few but awful remembered times when old Colonel had taken a cane to him in moments of anger or retribution.
Damn! Lying, sneaking niggers! All alike! Every one of you! Yeah!
He stopped using the belt on Gideon and turned, acting for a moment as if he were about to use it on the old woman.
You told me she was clean! You told me no nigger had ever put a hand on her, you lying old wench! What do you call that?
He pointed his finger like a dagger at Gideon.
Lord God, Massa, I didn't know. I has watched her. I beat her. And I ain't never let her get near no common soldier. I don't know how this didn't come to be here.
Well, he is here. And it's a safe bet he's been here before. Him and God knows how many others. There's no telling what kind of disease...
Newton swung his arm and slapped Hannah so hard that she fell against the iron bedstead. That brought Gideon up from the floor in a rush of anger. Newton reached to the chair again, and suddenly a pistol was in his hand.
Come on, you black bastard! There's nothing I'd rather do this minute than kill you! I'd kill all three of you!
No, please!
The old woman fell to her knees. Gideon stood with his fists clenched, a wild and angry roaring in his head. The full magnitude of the situation had not yet reached him, but in the fury of the moment, he was almost willing to risk the blast of that pistol. Only the officer's cold voice stopped him.
Come on! Come on and give me an excuse to kill you!
Only then did a chill work down Gideon's back and force him to stop. He was closer to death than he had ever been in his life. This man truly wanted to kill him. Gideon's stomach tied itself into a knot and cold sweat broke over his face. A voice called from outside.
What's going on in there?
It was another white man's voice.
Now you keep out of here! You keep out, you hear?
Is that you, Newton? What kind of mess have you gotten yourself into here?
Stay out of this, Hollander! It's none of your affair!
It was too late now. Hollander was already in. He struck a match and held it high, taking in the whole scene before the flame licked down close to his fingers. Hannah, naked on the bed, her head buried in her arms against the bedstead. The old woman on her knees, frightened to the point of collapse. Captain Newton in his underwear, pistol in his hand. Gideon Ledbetter standing with his hands half up, bleeding where the belt had cut him across his right ear. To Gideon's amazement, Hollander smiled.
This man struck me, Hollander. I have every right to shoot him.
Hollander was a moment in answering. He lighted a lamp and adjusted the wick.
I suppose you have, if that's the case. But do you want to stand in front of a court-martial and explain what you were doing here? Things like this can be messy.
Newton lowered the pistol slowly.
All right, but I'm going to see this man court-martialed. A soldier can be shot for striking an officer, sent to the penitentiary at least.
You would be within your rights, but the same questions would be asked, whether it's your court-martial or his. I wonder if you'd want your wife and children to hear about the circumstances. I wouldn't.
Newton's shoulders slumped. Hannah pulled a blanket from the bed and covered herself, belatedly. She remained huddled on the mattress, sobbing. Newton put on his clothes. His anger had drained largely and was replaced by shame. Faces peered curiously through the open door, one of them Jimbo's. The captain kept his back turned as he buttoned his coat.
Frank, could you get those people the hell away from here? This is bad enough without having every black heathen on the post staring. God knows what lies they'll tell.
God knows.
He stepped to the door.
You people move along now. Nothing has happened here, and anyway, it's all over.
Newton caught a glimpse of himself in a cracked old mirror and turned quickly away. His head was bowed.
Have I your promise as a gentleman that no word of this will get out?
I won't say anything, but I have no control over those people outside.
Anger flashed again in the captain's face as his gaze swept from Gideon to Hannah to the old woman.
You know the biggest mistake we made, Frank? It was in taking off their chains.
Hollander stared at the girl. She hid her face in the blanket.
Not all the chains.
He pointed his chin toward the door.
Wait for me out there, Newton. We'll go somewhere and talk.
The captain turned up the collar of the coat and pulled his hat low over his face. Without saying more, he stepped out into the darkness. From the open doorway came voices on the crisp night air. Gideon had stared through a haze. He felt stunned, frozen, as if he had been kicked in the belly by a mule. He blinked now, but the haze was still there. He turned toward a wall, not wanting to look at anybody, not wanting anybody to look at him. He leaned his head against the rough plaster. Jimbo entered the room and stood beside the lieutenant. He saw Gideon, his shoulders heaving, but no sound coming from him. Jimbo and the lieutenant looked at each other in embarrassed futility. A savage pain boiled up from the depths of Gideon's soul. He beat a fist against the wall until some of the poor plaster shook loose and fell.
Why, Hella? How come you to do it?
It was the old woman made her do it.
The granny woman couldn't hear, but she sensed that Jimbo was talking about her. She cringed fearfully in a corner. Gideon turned to the wizened old witch so she could see his lips.
Why? She's your granddaughter. She's your own blood kin.
She ain't no blood kin to me. Old Massa given her to me to raise up after her mama was sold off. She's mine to do with what I want to.
Gid, I've been wanting to tell you, but I couldn't. This yellow gal been a white man's gal ever since she and that old granny come here. Old woman been selling her to them white officers right along. Everybody knowed it just about, except you. You think all them other soldiers would have kept away like they done if they didn't know she was white man stuff?
For the first time in his life, Gideon wanted to kill Jimbo. In a searing rage, he grabbed him by the collar and pushed him back against the wall. Jimbo did not resist except to lift his arms protectively over his face.
It's God's truth, Gid, I swear.
Lieutenant Hollander laid a heavy hand upon Gideon's shoulder.
He's your friend, Charger. He's trying to help you. So am I. What he tells you is true. All of it.
Gideon wanted to close his ears with his hands, but his arms felt paralyzed.
Jimbo was trying to keep you out of trouble, Charger. He followed you here. I happened to be coming along when the commotion started, and he ran to me for help. If it hadn't been for Jimbo, you might be lying on the floor now, dead.
Gideon tried not to listen, but the relentless words drove like nails into his brain. He let go of Jimbo and took half a step backward. He felt terribly cold, and he began to shiver. He looked at Hannah, though her face was turned away and mostly covered by the blanket.
Why, Hannah?
Because she told me to.
Her voice was so weak he could barely hear.
You didn't have to do that.
She's my granny. I belong to her.
You don't belong to nobody. Nobody belongs to nobody. We got freedom.
You don't know nothing about freedom. She raised me up. I belong to her.
Gideon put his hands on her thin shoulders and shook her violently.
No, Hannah. No, you could have told her no.
She tore herself from Gideon's grasp and fell face down on the bed, half uncovered. Gideon stared at her through the burning of his tears. Shamed for hurting her, he pulled up the blanket to cover her again. His soul still rejected what his mind told him was true.
I don't believe it. That captain's a hard man. He come here and forced her.
Hollander shook his head.
You're a soldier, Charger, and a man. You have to face up to facts no matter how much they hurt. Just about every bachelor officer on the post has been over here. Some married ones, too. I've been here myself. $5 has been the standard fee.
The lieutenant tried to hold his eyes to Gideon's, but could not. Gideon covered his face with his hands, turned away, and cried as he had not cried since his mother was buried.
I've done all I can do here, Jimbo. Too much, perhaps. See after him. Get him to the barracks.
I'll see to him, sir.
The lieutenant paused at the door.
Can you hear me, old woman?
She was reading his lips, the fear still in her eyes.
The word'll get out quickly. I would advise you to be gone before it reaches the colonel's ears. Civilian teamsters are leaving in the morning with a supply train to Fort McCavitt. They'll take you for pay.
He glanced at the girl.
I hope you pay them with cash.
He was gone into the night chill. Jimbo picked up Gideon's fallen hat.
Your ear's bleeding, Gid. Come on, let's get home and fix it.
I love her, Jimbo. I don't want to leave her.
Jimbo took Gideon's arm.
Come on. This ain't no good place.
Gideon quit resisting. He paused at the door and looked at the girl.
Hannah, I'm coming back.
Outside in the cold air, he felt numb. He stumbled along, letting Jimbo pick the way across the grounds toward the barracks. A man rushed by them in the darkness, taking a shortcut from the barracks toward the river and St. Angela.
That's Findlay. Reckon he didn't get enough yet.
Gideon didn't care about Findlay. He cared about nothing except Hannah. He leaned his shoulder against the wall of the dark barracks and surrendered to a hot rush of tears, his body shaking. Jimbo turned away, letting the moment run its course. Gideon beat his fist against the rock wall until the tears were drained out of him. At last, Jimbo put his hand on Gideon's shoulder.
You gonna take the grip stand out here?
He led Gideon inside. Frank Hollander sat at a small square table in an earthen-floored picket hovel and stared at Captain Newton's somber, drawn face in the dim light of a single lantern. Hand-shaking, Newton poured the last whiskey from the bottle into a streaked glass. He glanced toward the sallow man who stood idly watching them from behind the plain bar of pecan timber. They were his only customers. Hollander motioned for the man to bring another bottle, and he laid some coins on the table. He could see dislike in the barkeep's eyes, though the man did not hesitate to accept his money. Newton downed half the glass, a little of the whiskey running on his chin. He rubbed a sleeve over it.
Be glad you never married, Frank. You have no idea the lengths a demanding woman can push you to.
Hollander toyed with his drink. In an hour, he'd not put away quite a full glass. He had sat in this dingy saloon, giving Newton support, while the captain drank himself gloriously drunk. He was not even sure why he was here. He had never liked Newton. He'd avoided his company when he could. But now, knowing the disaster that hung over the man like a dark thunderhead, he felt pity and an obligation to stand by him.
It was her that caused me to join the Black Regiment in the first place. I was a second lieutenant and not getting anywhere. She kept nagging about me being a failure. I knew promotion came easier in black units because not many officers wanted the appointment. I'd have known that a man can't stoop to a level beneath himself and keep his self-respect. You can't fool around a tar bucket without getting some black on you. You know what they say everywhere else in this damn army? They say if an officer isn't fit for promotion, the only way he can move up is to join a Negro regiment.
That's not true.
If enough people believe it, it had just as well be true. Stay with these damn people long enough and we'll turn black ourselves. Look at Colonel Grierson. They've tied his name to these black soldiers. They're calling them Grierson's brunettes. It doesn't matter anymore that he led one of the boldest Union raids of the war. They've already forgotten about that. He's just a commander of Negro soldiers now, and that's all they'll ever let him be. That's all any of us can ever be, Frank. They've tarred us with the black brush.
We can transfer out anytime we want to.
You think so? Yeah, you just try it. God knows I've tried. That wife of mine, she was glad enough to have a captain's pay. But now she nags at me to transfer to a white outfit. She's scared to death that some night when I'm out on patrol, one of those black devils will break into the house and climb in bed with her. If one ever did, it would be the disappointment of his life. Let me tell you.
He began an inventory of her domestic shortcomings, which left Hollander embarrassed, though he could understand why Newton had sought compensation along Laundry Row. At length, Newton stopped and stared narrow-eyed at him.
You never liked me, have you, Frank?
Hollander simply looked back at him. He saw no point in denying the undeniable.
You should never condemn a man until you've tried his shoes on.
I've never condemned you. And I don't now. But I can't agree with you, either. We haven't been banished from respectability just because we're officers in a black regiment.
Newton poured another drink.
You, bartender, come over here.
The man took his own time about it, making it clear that he was not subject to military discipline.
You don't think much of us, do you?
The barman seemed to regard that as a challenge. He took a step backward, closing his hand over the back of a chair, which he could use as a weapon.
I ain't let it bother me one way or t'other.
But it's true. You don't have much regard for us.
The bartender could not be accused of cowardice. He looked Newton squarely in the eyes.
If you was worth a damn, they wouldn't bury you in a Negro outfit.
Go on about your business, you! If that is the best opinion of a whiskey peddler in the cesspool like St. Angela, you can imagine how little they think of us in the rest of the army. An officer can be no better than his command. What is our command, Frank?
Hollander felt his face warming. In his opinion, Newton had ample cause to feel humble. But Lieutenant Frank Hollander had no intention of conceding inferiority.
I'll match my black soldiers against anybody's white ones. There's not a sergeant in Mackenzie's Fourth better than my Esau Nettles.
Can he write a report?
Newton knew the answer.
Damn lucky if he can read his own name. They can put a uniform on him. They can put them in on a roster and give them rank. But they can't make soldiers of them.
I'll make soldiers of mine.
Never in 100 years.
Sometime far up in the night, the rest of the men came into Gideon's barracks. Most of them, anyway. They were staggering, singing, laughing. Gideon tried to shut them out of his consciousness, but some of their talk soaked in. He was dimly aware that little Finley was not with them. He had not rejoined them after he had left the saloon. Someone suggested darkly that he might have drowned trying to cross the river in the wrong place, but someone else said that he was so full of wind that he couldn't sink. After that, they worried no more about Finley. Gideon was relieved when the last man flopped heavily into a bunk and the lamp was out again. Daybreak found him still staring at the ceiling. He had not slept. He had relived the terrible confrontation in the washerwoman's shack 100 times. He had waited and listened the last 2 hours for the bugle. But it somehow caught him by surprise, making his heart jump. He sat up woodenly and swung his feet to the floor, shivering at the morning chill. His stomach burned like acid from his sleeplessness. His head throbbed. This day was going to be hell. Nettles had been right. The weight of last night still lay as heavy on his shoulders as when he had gone to bed. He hardly touched breakfast, eating a little tasteless bread and sipping black coffee, which only made his stomach churn. After a while, he found himself in the stables, shoveling hay and manure, and not even remembering how he'd gotten there. He had been only dimly aware that little Finley had missed the morning formation and had been declared absent without leave. Ah, to hell with Finley. Jimbo had not spoken 4 words this morning, but he had contrived to stay near Gideon's side from the time they had made up their bunks. Gideon was both annoyed and thankful. Love could be bought, but friendship could not. Raking spilled hay from the corral, Gideon could see the washerwomen's shacks. Though he tried not to look, he couldn't help himself. He saw a big freight wagon pull up beside the York place and a white man step down, tying the reins to the front wheel while the fresh mule team stood patiently with ears working backward and forward toward the source of each new sound. Hannah York came out carrying a small trunk. The old woman followed, a bundle of clothing in her arms.
Don't trip on these steps coming off of this porch. I don't want you dropping my rocking chair.
He had known they would probably choose to leave, but somehow the stark reality had not fully reached him until he saw Hannah and the trunk and the wagon.
Jimbo, they're going.
And damn show time, too. Them white officers gonna want to skin them alive.
I can't let her go.
The hell you can't. Count yourself ahead that you was getting something free when all them officers was paying for it.
Gideon climbed over the fence. Jimbo grabbed at the gray work uniform but caught nothing in his hand except the cold morning air.
Gideon, you come back here.
But Gideon struck a brisk trot, only dimly aware that Sergeant Nettles had come to the corral fence and was shouting after him along with Jimbo. His legs were so unsteady that he fell once and went to his knees.
Oh, Hannah! Hannah!
She saw him and stopped halfway between the shack and the wagon. Then she turned quickly and hurried into the shack. When he reached the door, she came out carrying a wooden box of pots and pans.
Hannah! You ain't going!
She allowed herself only a quick look into his eyes, then dropped her chin.
We got to, else they'll bring us trouble.
Gideon pointed at the old woman.
Her trouble, not yours. She's the one that caused it all.
Hannah's big eyes filled with tears.
It was me she was selling. They'll come after me.
Not if you ain't with her no more. You stay here with me, Hannah.
Come on, gal. Man says we got to go.
Hannah turned to obey. Gideon caught her shoulder.
Turn around, Hannah. Listen to me.
She turned, but she didn't look him in the eyes.
Marry me, Hannah. And she's got nothing more to say over you.
She's my granny.
She's no blood kin. She said so herself. Anything you ever owed her, you've more than paid for. She don't own you. Nobody owns you. Marry me, and we'll live some way.
She avoided his eyes. In desperation, he gripped her shoulders and shook her.
Hannah, I love you.
The old woman had climbed up onto a wagon seat where a white man with a black beard watched the scene with a faint amusement.
You heard me, gal. I told you to come on up here.
I can't get in. I gotta go with her like she says. I always done what she says.
Hannah pulled herself from Gideon's strong grip and ran toward the wagon. She climbed up the wagon wheel and started to sit on the outside. The white driver gave the old woman a firm push and seated Hannah in the middle. His leg against hers, he popped the whip past Gideon's face. Gideon stepped back. The wheels groaned against the axle, needing more grease than they'd been given, and the wagon lurched past him. Hannah's head was down. She did not look at Gideon, but the old woman gave him a final glimpse of pure hatred. Had she really been a witch, he would have died then and there. Gideon stood watching as the wagon pulled away, moving around the corrals to pick up the McCabot Road. He wanted to run after it, but his legs seemed rooted to the ground. All he could do was stare and weep inside. Jimbo came up to him and stood in silence, offering friendship but not pushing it.
I told her I'd marry her. She'd have been free of that old woman. But it was like she was afraid to be free.
Some people don't know how not to be a slave.
He put his arm around Gideon's shoulder, and the two walked back to the corrals. It was upwards of noon when someone found Little Finley dead drunk in the arms of a chunky bell in one of St. Angela's picket hovels. He still had a few dollars in his pocket when he was brought back across the river under guard. It was a mystery to everybody where he'd gotten the money. A mystery to everybody except Jimbo. Grimly, he turned to Gideon, who was paying no attention to the little man's troubles. He was grieving over his own.
Gid, you've been keeping money in your footlocker, ain't you? Gideon, do you keep your money in your footlocker?
Yeah.
You better see if it's still there.
Gideon rummaged through the box. The sock that had held his savings was limp and empty.
That no-good thieving, sneaky son of a bitch!
Jimbo cursed the little man for seven kinds of thief and blackguard. Gideon just sat numb, shaking his head.
It don't matter. Everything I was saving it for is gone.
The Comanche raids came almost as a relief to the fort's dull early winter routine. Gideon could see excitement building in the brown-bearded face of the stocky civilian, Maloney, but the Indian's trail appeared fresher with each passing mile.
Boys, keep your eyes open, for we are fixing to come amongst them.
Gideon and Jimbo were riding alongside him to afford protection as the scout worked 50 yards in advance of Lieutenant Hollander's company, strung in a column of twos. In this case, Gideon had been thinking the army could have saved whatever daily stipend it was paying Maloney. The greenest recruit in the company could have followed this trail on the run. The Indians had accumulated a considerable remuda of stolen horses. Gideon didn't know how to estimate them, but Maloney said there was possibly as many as 50. He couldn't guess how many carried Indians, and that was a woeful intelligence gap. Maloney was pushing at a long trot. All the speed he felt was prudent for the company horses, consistent with the possibility that the chase might yet be a long one. Gideon kept finding himself pushing a little harder, getting out in front of Maloney.
Wait, Ledbetter! Get back here! I swear I never seen one of you blackbirds so damn anxious to get himself killed.
Of late, Gideon had found himself angering quickly at almost anything.
I thought we were supposed to catch them Indians.
Yeah, we will, and pretty soon, I expect. But it's apt to be a running fight when we do. Last thing a man wants in a running fight is a give-out horse, and that brown of yours ain't the best plug on the post even when he's fresh.
Gideon felt resentment on behalf of the horse, though he knew Maloney's appraisal was true. Man and mount had come to a certain accommodation, if not full understanding.
He'll last as long as the rest of them.
Only if the man sitting on his back has more sense than the horse.
Maloney's eyes narrowed.
Have you always been reckless, or is this a disease you just caught lately?
Recklessness had always been more an attribute of Jimbo than of Gideon. Yet he realized he had been acting with a certain rashness. He had skirted dangerously near to insubordination several times, particularly with Lieutenant Hollander, avoiding the man's eyes, obeying every order with an exaggerated military stiffness, showing his resentment without quite resorting to any overt act that might land him on report or even in the guardhouse. Maloney had no rank. Gideon owed him nothing beyond that undefined black-to-white deference which custom demanded and which was ingrained by Gideon's upbringing.
I hear there's people in St. Angela that say the Army's always careful not to let Indian tracks get too fresh.
St. Angela? Since when are you paying any attention to what them people say? I don't even drink their water, much less listen to their talk.
He heard a horse coming up behind him and turned his head.
What's that sergeant think he's doing, crowding us again?
He saw Nettles was coming up close behind them, well ahead of Hollander and the rest of the company. He'd been doing it regularly. Irritably, Maloney turned in the saddle.
You won't take my place up here, Nettles?
The sergeant made no apology.
Seems to me like, sir, that we can tell from the tracks which way they're going. They's hitting for where the Concho Griffin Road crosses over the Colorado.
I figured that out a long time ago. But if we push these horses too hard, we'll be fighting a bear with a willow switch.
There's people on that river. White people.
Maloney spurred into an easy lope, looking over his shoulder as if expecting Hollander to call him down. But Hollander picked up the speed. The reaction followed jerkily down the line of troopers like freight cars at the end of a train, responding to a surge of speed by the engine. Gideon stared back at the lieutenant, resentment welling up like something rotten in his stomach. He'd been unable to look at Hollander without conjuring up an ugly image of him lying with Hannah in that miserable laundress shack. The anger had simmered in him like stew over a slow fire.
Boy, you better look in front of you, not behind! Up ahead is where the Indians are at!
Gideon tried to focus on the pursuit. The brown had swung into a leg-stretching run, his hoofs swishing as they reached through the dry grass. Quail flushed with a frantic flutter of wings and sent an involuntary tremor through Gideon and made him raise the carbine he carried across his lap. He topped a rise in the rolling ground and glimpsed a movement far ahead, a horseman. He pointed.
Yonder!
Jimbo raised his carbine to his shoulder, then lowered it, for the rider was far beyond range, especially for a rifleman on a running horse. More than likely, the Indian was a rear guard. Maloney turned to signal the lieutenant, but Hollander had seen. He spurred hard, leaving part of the company well behind him, rapidly overtaking the three men in front. Sergeant Nettles, on Black Napoleon, moved up abreast of Gideon.
Come on, Ledbetter. Don't let that horse go to sleep.
The brown seemed to be putting out all the speed he had. The Indian, fully half a mile ahead of them, was keeping the distance constant, or perhaps gaining a little. Somewhere up yonder, Gideon realized the main body of Indians depended upon this scout to bring them word of pursuit before it came too close. Somebody fired a shot.
Hold your fire! He'll tell them soon enough!
The pressure of the other horses closing the gap behind him did more to push the brown to exertion than Gideon's spurs had done. The electric excitement seemed to reach the animal, and Gideon could feel the response through his legs. From under him, the racing hoofbeats in the grass became like a low rumble of thunder. He found his heartbeat drumming like that of the horse beneath him. From far ahead came the flat, distant echo of gunfire. The sergeant half turned in the saddle, waving his Spencer.
Come on! Spur up!
It was the lieutenant's prerogative, not his. But Hollander leaned forward in the saddle as if in obedience to the sergeant's order. Gideon heard a few more shots, then nothing except the rush of the horses through the grass. A grayish cloud began to rise. Smoke. He saw fear in the face of Esau Nettles. Gray Horse had known they should not return to the settler's cabin on the Colorado River. The coyote had told him so. But the insistence and greed of bear that turns to fight had prodded him into going against his medicine. Looking behind him now, he could see that the whole raiding trip had been a mistaken judgment. By now, they should all have been in the big winter encampment with the main band instead of here on the open prairie, running for their lives like scattered rabbits. Bear's agitation had brought them to this, but the decision had been Gray Horse's own. The blame would have to be his. Most of the band had already moved into winter camp, where tall canyon walls turned away the bitter north wind. But Gray Horse, by custom, was traveling with his wife's family and some other friends and relatives, setting up temporary hunting camps and trying to get more meat to carry through the winter. The buffalo had seemed fewer this fall, the hunting more difficult. Green Willow's father, old Many Coos, had been chief of the hunting camp. The crippled Eagle Feather had insisted upon going along to hunt despite the slow mending of his broken leg. His counsel had been good, but his riding ability was badly impaired. He was forced to spend most of his time in camp, where his wife, Antelope, cared for him. It was just as well, for the hunters found little game anyway. The notion of a raid had sprung up one night around the council fire as the men grumbled over their meager success. If they could not find buffalo, they might at least ride south and find horses in the settlements. Supplied with horses, the hunters would not straggle into the encampment, ashamed. Gray Horse had been chosen leader despite his misgivings. Green Willow's stomach was beginning to swell. He would have preferred to stay close by her into the spring when his son would be born. He gave no thought to the possibility that the firstborn might be a girl. He could not in good conscience remain behind when Finds the Good Water was going. His wife was much further along than Green Willow. Bear volunteered to lead in Gray Horse's stead, but only a couple of the men supported him. Since Eagle Feather was obviously unable, Gray Horse was the majority's choice. His medicine had been proven. His reluctance tempered by the new spirit he saw in the young men, he promised Green Willow a quick return and led the warriors south for one more accounting with the Tejanos before the snow began to fly. Their appetite was whetted early by the sight of buffalo soldiers on horseback accompanying two men in a wagon, but Gray Horse did not consider the few horses adequate to risk stirring up military pursuit so soon. They tested the defenses of the military party at the abandoned old soldier fort that night and found the stone corrals too well guarded. Daylight had brought them to the new settler's cabin on the Colorado. Bear wanted to lay waste to the place and take its prizes then and there.
Let them be a warning to others who would steal our land and put fear into their hearts, so they may run home like dogs, dragging their tails.
But Gray Horse reminded him that the men had come for horses, and horses were to be found in large numbers farther south.
Time enough to kill these Tejanos when we come back this way.
They did well in the days that followed. Near Fort McCabot, and farther south and east, they gathered up close to 40 horses whose owners valued life more than property. The only disappointment was that none of the white men offered much fight, and no warrior was privileged to take a scalp or count coup. In keeping with his promise to Bear, Gray Horse had pointed the returning warriors and the stolen Ramuda toward the Colorado crossing. Just north of the Concho River and east of Fort Concho, they came upon Coyote, cousin to the Wolf. He cut diagonally across their trail. 100 yards away, he stopped, looking back at them, circled twice, and looked straight at Gray Horse. Then he changed direction. The message was clear to Gray Horse, if to no one else. The Wolf Spirit had sent Coyote to warn him that this party must change direction too.
Coyote wants us to swing to the east, away from the big fort.
The Wolf Spirit knew everything. It must have known that the soldiers were coming. But Bear went into a fury.
Everyone knows a coyote is not to be trusted. He has always been a trickster and does not love man. Coyote is not to be believed. Has Gray Horse forgotten his promise? I will go to the crossing alone if I have to.
His insistence was so strong that he swung other men to his side. Even Limping Boy, though he did not speak against Gray Horse, did not speak on his behalf. His gaze on the departing coyote, Gray Horse reluctantly gave in. They would go to the crossing and teach those Tejanos whose land this was. They left the loose horses behind a little way to prevent the noise or the dust from alerting the farmers. Moving along in the cover of the scrub timber that grew down almost to the river's waterline, they came within 50 yards of the cabin unseen. Gray Horse thought the dog must be away hunting, or else he would have raised a racket by now. The warriors took time to apply their paint, Gray Horse carefully making the lightning streak and the wolf tracks across his body to turn away bullets. When the men were ready, he led them through the last timber and paused to survey the ground. He saw two men. One was on the roof of the cabin applying shingles. The other worked some paces away, strengthening the temporary corral where they secured their workhorses at night. Those two animals stood hitched to a wagon in which many cut timbers were stacked.
I wonder where the yellow-haired woman might be.
As if in answer, she stepped out of the cabin door, wiping her hands on a white apron. The wind caught her hair and lifted it.
I want her alive. She can be a wife for me until I get a real one.
He was still a bachelor, still borrowing his brother's wives. Grey Horse expected the attack to be easy. The ground the warriors had to cover was short, and the farmers would be taken by surprise. They probably would not even have time to reach their weapons. The warriors rushed out of the timber at a gallop, shrilling their war cries that so often froze their enemies in fear. Almost in the same instant, the man on the roof jumped down, grabbing up a rifle Grey Horse had not seen. The man in the corral dropped behind the stacked timbers and fired his first shot before the raiders were halfway across the open space. The woman ran into the cabin, slamming its heavy door. Grey Horse knew that these were not the weak-kneed white men he had seen at other times, running in terror at the sight of a feather. Though doomed from the first by superior numbers and the force of the charge, these two Tejanos were of a breed that would fight until life had been hammered from them. It was as if these whites were part Indian themselves, for they yielded no ground and gave no quarter. Win or lose, they fought with a savage determination that did not quit short of victory or death. Grey Horse struck with his war club and took first coup on one farmer. Bear got the other. The warriors rode them down, beating them to the ground and driving arrow after arrow into their bodies. Yet the men struggled and fought until their last breaths had passed. Such men should have been Comanches, Grey Horse thought. The dog came rushing from across the river. It took three arrows to bring it down. The woman stood her ground no less than the men. She opened a small rifle port in the wall of the cabin and thrust out the barrel of a big muzzle-loading gun. The first shot hit no warriors. But the heavy cloud of black smoke choked the men, who slammed their shoulders against the door, trying to break it in.
Hit it harder!
Grey Horse jumped to the rifle port, hoping to grab the barrel if she poked it out again. Bear brought up a heavy cedar post, which the white men had cut for the corral. Yeah! With it, he and some of the others battered at the door. When the rifle barrel appeared, Grey Horse gripped it just behind the front sight. Despite the heat that seared his hands, he shoved it back violently against the woman's shoulder. Fire burned the side of his face, the roar hammering in his ears. The door splintered. Bear rushed into the cabin. He came back dragging the struggling woman. She beat at his face with her hands as he dragged her out. Soon he had all the volunteer assistance he needed to subdue her.
You are going to be my wife. I'm going to teach you the first duty of a wife.
He began tearing her dress. Grey Horse watched a moment, his own blood aroused by the woman's struggles. The men would expect Bear to share her. Grey Horse saw nothing wrong with that. This had been a long trip. The men had been away from their own women, just as he had been away from Green Willow. The people had agreed long ago that the first thing to do with a new slave woman was to shame and humiliate her, to show her she was nothing, and that she must subject herself entirely to the will of her owner. The process had a ritualistic aspect. In dishonoring the woman, the warriors, in effect, dishonored her people. This was the way war had always been fought by the plains folk, whether against enemy tribes or against the Mexicans and the Tejanos. Grey Horse entered the cabin to see what might be worth taking. He picked up the smoking rifle first, then began pulling blankets from a crudely built bed. He heard a whimper from beneath it and swiftly drew his knife. He threw off a corn shuck mattress and found a small girl hiding beneath the bed. He dragged her out and carried her through the door.
Grey Horse has found himself a wife too!
Grey Horse held up the girl for the others to see. He would take Green Willow, a daughter, to help care for their son.
No!
The men drew back suddenly from the woman. She stood almost naked, her clothing in shreds. Her eyes widened as she saw Grey Horse carrying her little girl. She ran at him, her arms outflung.
Look out, Grey Horse! Do not let her touch you!
In a blur of movement, he saw Bear fit an arrow to his bowstring and draw it back. Startled, Grey Horse stood in confusion, holding tightly to the squirming, crying girl.
Give me!
The arrow drove into the woman's back just as she reached Grey Horse, the feathered shaft vibrating from the impact. She grasped at the girl as Grey Horse turned away, and the woman caught hold of the medicine bag around his neck. Her other hand touched his arm. She clung for a moment, fighting for life, then slid to the ground. The leather string drew tight around Grey Horse's neck and broke. She lay face down at his feet, the medicine bag clutched in her dying hand. Horrified, Terrapin walked way around her to reach Grey Horse.
Oh, she was bleeding! She has contaminated your medicine!
Grey Horse felt as if he had fallen shoulder deep into icy water. His jaw fell, the enormity of the situation overwhelming him. He knew now why the men had stepped so quickly away from the woman. They had discovered she was in her menstrual period. To touch such a woman, or be touched by her, was a taboo that went back into antiquity. The spirits had given down the rule when the people were first granted dominion over the world. Not only had Grey Horse been touched by her, but his buffalo scrotum medicine bag was in her hand, the bag he had worn constantly since he had gained his wolf power. He looked down on her and trembled, his feet frozen to the ground. Limping Boy brought a stick from a pile of firewood. With it, he pried her fingers open without having to touch her himself. He flipped the bag away from her. Steeling himself, he finally grasped it and extended it toward Grey Horse. Grey Horse only stared.
Perhaps no harm was done. She had it only a moment.
Still holding the girl, Grey Horse reached out woodenly and retrieved the bag from his cousin's nervous hand. He touched it against his body. It felt dead to him and cold. A shudder ran through him as he backed away from the woman. A dead snake had been known to inflict a fatal bite to the man who had killed it. This woman, dead, might be taking a terrible revenge.
Ah!
In a flash of anger, he drew back the knife and was about to slay the girl in revenge for what her mother had done to him. A thought came to him, saving her life. Because the girl's mother had seemingly blighted his medicine, perhaps a strong shaman could use the girl in some way to lift the blight and restore lost power. He had no idea if such a thing was possible, but it was worth trying. In the meantime, Green Willow could use the girl's help around camp. Later, he might trade her for a horse or two. No one scalped the woman. All were afraid to touch her again. But they cleaned out whatever was useful from the cabin, and Bear set it afire. From afar, the sound of a shot penetrated the dark clouds of Grey Horse's mind. He saw a rear guard riding hard toward them from the south. Behind him rose a cloud of dust. Grey Horse could not see what made it, but he knew the soldiers.
Says Little, Terrapin, get started with the stolen horses. Run them as fast as they will go. The rest of you hang back and protect the rear.
Kill the devil child, or let me, Grey Horse, if you lack the power.
Grey Horse turned his fury on his cousin.
It was you who had to come here. It was you who had to have the woman. Look then!
He pointed toward the oncoming soldiers.
See what you have brought us to!